Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
U.S. General Ken Keene's humanitarian invasion of Haiti ramps up, and the nation begins to step back from the brink.
We will increase our capacity both within the number of troops, but as importantly with logistical vehicles and enable us to get out to the much-needed areas.
Meanwhile, aboard the USNS Comfort hospital ship, Naval Surgeon Tim Donahue says his patients are resting comfortably.
Our youngest patient is now 72 hours old, and our oldest is 82.
Generals and hospitals in Haiti on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. It's Thursday, January 21st. I'm back in the saddle here in New York City. And The Takeaway, Miles O'Brien in for Celeste Headlee. It seems to be, are we approaching a critical threshold in Haiti where things begin to improve? Maybe we're getting there.
Maybe so. You know, 24 hours ago, there was an aftershock. You have to wonder how many people
Indeed.
Are sleeping indoors in Haiti right now.
Indeed. Well, we're going to get right to the top stories we're following this morning, including I had the pleasure yesterday of speaking to the highest-ranking military officer in the U.S., the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen. And I asked him how much the difficulties of the Haitian government in the wake of this earthquake have held back the arrival of medical supplies in a time of really critical moment-to-moment need in Haiti.
I'm not aware the impact, the difficulties the Haitian government has had in standing up. I mean, it was in great part decapitated by this. They lost a lot of senior people. They also lost a lot of ministries. So it's in its own way trying to stand back up as well. So I haven't seen them impeding progress here. We certainly are in touch with them about what's going on. And again, there's a big international medical effort right now. And literally as we speak, a little more than a week after the earthquake, while we still have a long way to go with food, a long way to go with water, a great emphasis right now is being placed on getting the medical help out there. There are clear challenges, significant challenges, that remain on the medical side that we're really trying to break through.
The chairman of the Joint Chiefs talks to The Takeaway. We'll have more from my interview with Admiral Mike Mullen in just a moment.
Aside from the aid Admiral Mullen spoke of, more U.S. troops are also on the way to Haiti. Right now, some 11,000 soldiers are in and around Haiti, with another 2,000 Marines heading to the earthquake zone soon. Lieutenant General Ken Keene, the commander of the U.S. military effort in Haiti, describes the mission this way.
We're building this airplane while it flies.
Meanwhile, docked at the Port-au-Prince Bay, the USNS Comfort is treating some of the worst-off patients. The naval surgeon on board is impressed with how long many badly injured Haitians were able to hang on.
The fact that they've made it, you know, 7 days out, 8 days out with these injuries and they're still here just speaks, you know, worlds towards how resilient, you know, they are.
But in the disaster zone that is Port-au-Prince, the scene remains desperate with limited supplies and doctors. This aid worker says some of the deaths she's seeing at a makeshift hospital are hard to take.
Harder when they come in conscious and begging you to save them. And there's nothing we can do.
President Obama and the First Lady are joining Americans in making donations to help the victims in Haiti. They're donating $15,000 from their personal bank account to the Clinton Bush Haiti Fund.
Quick couple of stories here at home. The president is blaming the Democrats' stunning loss of their filibuster-proof Senate majority on his failure to connect to the economic frustrations of the middle class, which may be why the president's going to step up his pressure on Wall Street later this morning, announcing a plan to give the government new powers to limit the size of the nation's largest banks, as well as to stop them from trading on their own accounts. Markets, Miles?
Asian and European markets mixed. Futures down. The Dow gets underway at 10,603. S&P opening at 1,138. The NASDAQ at 2,291.
Our tech segment later on this morning, we're going to talk about Apple's rumored new IT project. But what do we want you to talk about? The Democrats' loss in Massachusetts. It's because of that 60 votes in the Senate reform rule. What do you think? It saved us from health care reform, or did it put a monkey wrench in the works of Congress? Do you think we should change the 60-vote rule in the Senate? Call us at 8778-MY-TAKE or send us an email, mytake@thetakeaway.org. More on Haiti and Mullen in a moment. Good morning, everyone. Good morning, Miles O'Brien.
Good morning.
We begin this morning with more of that wide-ranging conversation I had yesterday at the Pentagon with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen. Haiti was just one part of the discussion. And a moment ago, we heard about how U.S. forces are working with the Haitian government. The Associated Press says the military has begun preparing about 100 tents at Guantanamo Bay for Haitian migrants. I asked Admiral Mullen, how important are facilities like Guantanamo Bay to transitioning the injured from Haiti?
We're aware of the medical support that is available in a place like Guantanamo, and we haven't seen any large requirement for that right now. What's been the struggle initially with this is because those who have been injured so badly, many of them are crush injuries. We've seen infection set in, and many amputations have had to occur. So you just can't show up to a medical facility. If you will, it's not any kind of non-serious injury. We're really trying to focus on those major ones, but there are also significant additional medical requirements that we're trying to meet. It takes supplies, it takes distribution, and we're just not there yet. An awful lot of people working to try to get this right, and I see this as, along with food and water, as the most significant challenge.
Is the Gitmo facility available to you, however, for people to move off island?
It's an option, certainly an option that General Fraser and General Keane and USAID has as a part of this. But there are actually distribution issues. Literally, there are hospitals on Haiti that have rooms. Now, they're not located necessarily right downtown, so we think we need to work to distribute some of those patients who are in hospitals once they've received the care to move them out to some of these other areas.
All right, moving to other responsibilities. The president said, referring to the Christmas Day bombing attempt of the Northwest Airlines jet, that we are at war with Al-Qaeda. Let's be clear. I believe those were the words. Is that your understanding, Admiral?
Yeah, it is very clear. This is a group, and I've said this over a long period of time, and it has been diminished somewhat in the last couple of years, but this is a group that's still trying to kill Americans. They're still trying to kill Westerners. The December 25th incident in Detroit is an example of that. The Headley arrest, the Zazi arrest, the five Americans who were recently picked up in Pakistan, all of that is very much associated with an overall strategic direction to still try to generate catastrophic attacks, killing innocent people, killing innocent Americans, as many as they can. And so in that regard, you bet we're at war with them.
Special Envoy Richard Holbrooke uses the term AFPAC a lot, and it's proliferated, I think, in a lot of discussions here in Washington and around the world. Since the surge was announced in Afghanistan, do you see the rules of engagement regarding the sanctity of the Pakistan-Afghan border evolving in some way that perhaps might give U.S. forces more of a reason to cross the border and operate inside Pakistan, either with drones or with actual infantry?
I see right now. Now, I don't see any circumstances at this point where we're going to have any ground troops that would cross that border. I mean, that's just not part of it. I don't see it. It hasn't changed as a result of this strategy. The question about Afghanistan and Pakistan, what I have learned over the last two-plus years, having been heavily engaged in this, is it's not one country or another. They're two sovereign countries. Obviously, they border each other. And they're inextricably linked in many, many ways, in particular at that border. And that's where we believe Al-Qaeda leadership resides. That's where the Afghan Taliban have a safe haven, and they use that safe haven to come into Afghanistan to kill Afghan citizens, to kill Afghan security forces, and to kill Americans. And so we're very focused on that and that border. That border is one that I believe is the epicenter of terrorism.
In terms of the rules of engagement with our relationship with Pakistan, help me to understand how a Pakistan military officer might be involved in drone surveillance on Pakistani territory. Would they initiate? Would they provide intelligence? Would they provide suggestions or targets? Or is it completely a U.S.-initiated operation?
Well, I don't talk about these operations in any kind of detail at all. Where we are in terms of what we're doing with the Pakistani military, and we've been doing it for some time, is we have provided training and support for their operations. I was there in December. I went up and spent the entire day in SWAT. And a year ago, there were many who had predicted SWAT would never return to what it was because the insurgents had basically taken it over. Well, the PAC mill went in there, and they basically have turned it around, gotten rid of the insurgents. They achieved something many people predicted that they couldn't achieve, as an example. So, and we have worked to support them in terms of training, and I've been to the training center where we've done that, and it's really been exquisite training. They've worked hard, they've learned well, and they've had a big impact.
Finally, in the White House Situation Room that I happened to pass through yesterday, I noticed there were a number of digital clocks that sort of monitor places around the world that are obviously of interest. Of course, there is Washington, there was Kabul, there was Port-au-Prince. But I noticed that there was Sana'a, capital of Yemen. Is that an indication that surveillance on the part of the White House and security operations and perhaps the Pentagon, surveillance in Yemen is as important as the relief operation in Port-au-Prince right now or the operation in Kabul, that it has a similar priority?
Well, right now we're very focused on Haiti, and it really is at the top of the list. But we don't do that and ignore the other challenges. And I have been concerned for a significant period of time about the growing potential and now what I see in execution of a new safe haven for al-Qaeda leadership in Yemen. And it's clearly there. And it goes to Fort Hood and the Alaqui, who is the imam, who is actually an American citizen, spent a lot of time here, who is at the center of fostering not just Hassan, but a lot of other activities as an example. And he resides in Yemen. And there are others. And so we've got an increased level of focus on Yemen. We've increased our support to the Yemen security forces. I don't just mean recently. We've actually done that over the last couple of years. We expect it to grow significantly over the next year and for the same reason, to enable them to get at this very serious threat, not just to us, but also to the people of Yemen and the government of Yemen. It is in certainly our list of top priorities that we're spending a lot of time on.
Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Michael Mullen. More of our conversation tomorrow. You can see more of the interview on thetakeaway.org. And at 15 minutes after the hour, let's check in on some stories we're following this morning. Miles?
2 days after his Senate win, Massachusetts Republican Senator-elect Scott Brown is heading to Washington. The time of Brown's swearing-in remains a question. Meanwhile, President Obama spoke to ABC last night about the Democrats' loss in Massachusetts.
Here's my assessment of not just the vote in Massachusetts, but the mood around the country. You know, the same thing that swept Scott Brown into office swept me into office. People are angry and they're frustrated.
Still, the president vows to press on with health care reform. We'll get more on that from our Washington correspondent, Todd Zwillick, in just a few moments. Meanwhile, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has been answering criticism that the aid effort in Haiti is moving too slowly.
Of course, I'm not satisfied about getting material and personnel in for everyone who needs it, but I am realistically aware of the difficulties.
Yesterday, the World Food Program said it distributed food to more than 200,000 people, but said it could take as long as a month to get food to the estimated 2 million who need it.
U.S. Secretary Gates is in Pakistan for unannounced meetings with military and civilian leaders. He says he plans to explain the latest U.S. strategy in Afghanistan and find out about Pakistan's latest offensive in the border areas. And finally, Americans are more than twice as likely to express a prejudice against Muslims than they are against Christians, Jews, or Buddhists, according to a new Gallup World Religion Survey. That's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Miles?
Louise Story is up with a look at business. Stay with us.
Hey, you want that to go?
So our first news takeout this morning is all about that political takedown in Washington, D.C. Todd Zwillick, Washington correspondent, joins us. So congressional Democrats were kind of figuring out what to do next based on the result in Massachusetts. Todd? Hi, good morning, John. Yep, they absolutely are. This whole idea, John, of having the House and Senate agree on a health care bill and then having the Senate, you know, pass it with 60 votes while it can before Scott Brown gets to Washington seems to be completely off the table now. Listen to Harry Reid from yesterday.
We're not going to rush into anything. We're going to wait until the new senator arrives before we do anything more on health care.
Now, Todd, can you decode that for me? What's deep in the text there?
All right. Well, on the face of it, we're not going to do anything. Democrats have decided it would be politically unsavory to ram something through on health care before Scott Brown gets there when they still have 60 votes. Fine. The subtext, though, is that health care still has to get done. They want to move on to other things. It's been out here long enough. And where's all the pressure now? Harry Reid has thrown all the pressure back onto Nancy Pelosi in the House. That's what he's done with that statement, because it still has to pass. And remember, we sort of mentioned yesterday, I think, that one of the only options they have now is to have the House simply pass the bill that the Senate has already passed. Now, the House hates that bill, and they would have to do a whole bunch of other maneuvers to make it palatable to a lot of the liberals and progressives and even some of the conservatives, frankly, everybody in the Democratic side in the House. So Reid has just thrown it all on Nancy Pelosi there. So story's in the House now.
Well, the pressure for some House members might actually be welcome, since they're sick and tired of being ignored for so long. But Congress is moving on some hate legislation. Let's talk about that before we go.
Yeah, a whiff of bipartisanship. Yesterday, the House passed unanimously, John, a bill. Listen just to the details really quickly. Anything you give to Haiti between January 11th, which is when the earthquake was in Haiti, and March 1st, you can write off of your 2009 taxes. So you can take the deduction right away. You just have to show a phone bill showing the contribution and the name of the organization. The Senate should pass it today unanimously. So a whiff of bipartisanship so that make it a little bit easier for people to give to Haiti.
Congress doing something. There we go. Todd Zwillick, Washington correspondent. Thanks, Todd.
A whiff of coffee now in our takeout money session. After losing a lot of steam, Starbucks has brewed a venti-sized profit of $241 million for the most recent quarter. Louise Story knows a latte about business.
Oh, my God.
I'm sorry. I can't stop.
This is pretty corny.
She covers it for our partner, the New York Times. Hello, Louise. How did Starbucks make such a good comeback here?
Good morning. It is a pretty good comeback. This is quadruple the profit from a year ago. You know, the thing is that Starbucks is sort of an economic indicator. It's the luxury coffee indicator.
It's a leading indicator, isn't it?
It is.
That's the first thing you'd cut out.
Right. Well, you know, what's interesting is that back in 2007, we saw the housing market deteriorating. But of course, it did not become widespread and known that there was a recession until 2008. You remember it was the fall of 2008 when your stock portfolio tumbled dramatically. But back in 2007, when we only saw early indicators, the last quarter of 2007 is when Starbucks profits and the transactions at its store started stumbling. So it stumbled early. And now, a couple years later, when people are saying the economy looks like it's getting a little better, Starbucks looks like it's improving.
So this is actually really something that economists and the street should be watching. Coffee sales at Starbucks.
Possibly. I mean, the other explanation is that Howard Schultz, you know, who is their very famous founder,
He's like the Steve Jobs of coffee.
He is the Steve Jobs of coffee. He had left day-to-day running of the company. He came back a couple years ago. He
was, like Steve Jobs.
Right,
had to come
exactly.
back, right?
He came back. He was dismayed by their growth. He said, there are too many stores. We've lost our spirit. And so he's really brought back the entrepreneurial spirit. That has helped. But, you know, sales are up. And I think, you know, the question I'm kind of wondering, maybe throw it out to the listeners, is, you know, are we starting to feel good enough about the economy again, safe
Leading
in our
indicator.
Jobs, yeah. that we'll go out and buy a $5 macchiato? Will you buy a macchiato?
I don't know if I'd buy a macchiato. I need to pronounce it first. I might spend more at Starbucks. But Jack Welch famously used to say over at General Electric years ago that when people buy light bulbs, that's a sign that the economy is coming back. These retail symbols are interesting.
So wait a minute. Were they in the dark when they...
Well, no. When people stock up on light bulbs, they feel confident about the economy. That's what he used to say. Yeah.
Otherwise, they read by candlelight. All right. Louise Story. She'll be back with more a little bit later. Our takeout this morning on business.
Our last takeout comes from the voices of our listeners. Tuesday's stunning defeat for Democrats in Massachusetts got a lot of people wondering about why that loss up there in Massachusetts. What do our listeners say?
Hi, this is Kelly from Pittsburgh. The Massachusetts election speaks to the way independents feel about what's gone on the healthcare issue, because what good is healthcare reform if it's not actually going to help anybody? The House reform, the states can opt out, and the Senate, it's too expensive. So I'm kind of glad Scott Brown got in, even though I'm not really a Scott Brown fan.
Writing from Detroit, I'm really frustrated by the idea that the American people once again seem not to be able to make their mind up about what they want to do. Clearly need a national health care system, and obviously this is not the way to get it.
An independent voice and a frustrated voice there, and you can reach us, join the conversation at 877-8MYTAKE or weigh in at mytake@thetakeaway.org. So did Democrats lose because of the health care issue, or maybe it was political incompetence?
This is Jeff from Brooklyn. I'm frustrated because this election up in Boston is not, I don't see it as a referendum against Obama. We had a weak candidate with a bad campaign running against Brown.
This is Paul from Livermore, California. You know, I don't know why Democrats are so shocked at Martha Coakley's defeat, considering how ineptly her campaign was run. I mean, she lost to a Ken doll. What, did Obama make you think that the Democrats had finally figured out how to win elections? Obama was the exception. The Democratic ranks are still full of horrible campaign people.
Meanwhile, some of you thought it was about time. We got this email. No one, no matter how much good they have done, should hold a Senate seat for almost 50 years. That spells entitlement. And that is apparently how the Democrats lost the seat, by taking it for granted. But looking back at it, we got one simple way to describe the Democrats' loss.
Scott Brown displacing Ted Kennedy. It's like Lawrence Welk replacing Toscanini.
8778, my take. Top of that.
Coming up, was Tuesday really Independence Day? Of course, I mean independent voters. We'll talk in a few moments about independence and Tuesday's defeat for Democrats. Here are some of the other stories we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. President Obama is sending more U.S. troops to Haiti right now. About 11,000 soldiers are in and around the country. Another 2,000 Marines heading to the earthquake zone soon. The president telling ABC News U.S. relief efforts help America's image.
I want to make sure that when America projects its power around the world, it's not seen only when it's fighting a war.
Part of that projection includes the USNS Comfort, which is now docked off the coast of Port-au-Prince, treating some of the worst-off patients. Tim Donahue is a surgeon on board.
I've got five operating rooms running right now on patients that are getting, you know, washouts, amputations, and revisions of their amputations. So it's picking up at a good clip.
In another move to help Haiti recover, there are reports of the banks reopening this weekend, which could help the flow of money from Haitians overseas.
The Associated Press says the U.S. has begun preparing tents at Guantanamo Bay in case there's a mass migration of Haitians fleeing the island. Yesterday at the Pentagon, I asked Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Admiral Mike Mullen about the possibility of sending earthquake survivors to Cuba.
Is the Gitmo facility available to you, however, for people to move off island?
It's an option, certainly an option that General Fraser and General Keane and USAID has as a part of this.
In Congress, Senate Democrats have proposed allowing the federal government to borrow another $2 trillion to pay its bills. That means the national deficit could reach $14.3 trillion. So what's your online password? You have to think about that. According to our partner, the New York Times, you probably don't. The most popular password is 123456. And the second most popular password, 12345.
12345.
12345.
Yes.
That's amazing. I've got the same combination on my luggage.
Password was even a top 20 password. Internet security analysts say don't make it so easy for hackers, folks. Let's check on the markets. Asian and European markets are mixed. Futures down. The Dow gets underway at 10,603. The S&P at 1,138. And the NASDAQ opens probably downward, but starting at 2,291. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Hope they're paying close attention, because tonight the independent voice of Massachusetts has spoken.
It's a newly elected Massachusetts, well, Senator-elect Scott Brown in his acceptance speech on Tuesday. You know, they don't call him independent for nothing. Are independents getting more conservative, or are they just a contrary group? Either way, They are how elections are decided in this country. A year ago, they sent Obama and a commanding Democratic majority to Washington. In Massachusetts, they seem to repudiate that decision. Let's get into this. Ross Baker is a political science professor at Rutgers University, and Jay Campbell is vice president of Hart Research, a polling firm. Gentlemen, good morning to you.
Good morning, Ross.
Let's begin with you, Ross. Independents. They're hard to figure, aren't they? And they're hard for political pros to corral, aren't they?
Political scientists hate them. Political scientists love Democrats and Republicans because they're more predictable. Independents, you're untethered. They kind of go with the wind. There was a time when, in fact, independents were kind of treated contemptuously because they were considered to be less educated and less affluent than voters with strong party attachments. Now that's not the case. Independent voters tend to be somewhat more affluent, better educated, but still highly volatile, unpredictable, mercurial.
So the smarter people are leaving the parties. Jay Campbell, tell us a little bit about the numbers. Are independents becoming more conservative, or are they just generally contrary to whomever is in power?
Well, first I'd say that in contrast to political scientists, pollsters love independents because they're sort of a fascinating group to watch and to follow. And I think, Miles, the answer is both. For one thing, as Ross said, by their very nature, they're independent. They are contrary. They don't fall into the neat categories that so often Republicans and Democrats can and do. At the same time, we've seen evidence that, in fact, independents are becoming more conservative over time. In a poll we conducted for the Wall Street Journal and NBC News in December, we asked independents straight up, have you found yourself over the past couple of years becoming more conservative, or do you not feel that way? And almost half, 48% of independents say yes, in fact, they have been becoming found themselves becoming more conservative.
And this is over what time frame, though?
This is over the past couple of years. It was a vague time frame, but if you sort of work backwards, past couple of years, it does include the 2006 elections, where we found that the number of Republicans at that time sort of started to drop a little bit, the number of people who identified themselves as Republican.
So,
the theory being that a lot of former Republicans are now calling themselves independents, and thus becoming a bit more conservative. At the same time, as you pointed out, they voted for change in Washington in 2008, and I would argue in 2006 as well. Part of the reason that the Democratic Party is having so much trouble now with this group is because we found that they don't necessarily think that Barack Obama has sort of sealed the deal with the change in Washington that they were expecting and that they voted for.
So, Ross, the two-party system, is it being completely undermined here? Is this the end of the two-party system we're seeing unfold?
Well, I think for a time, in some states, you've had the electorate divided pretty much into thirds. A third Democratic, a third Republican, a third Independent. Democrats, of course, were said to be to outnumber Republicans in Massachusetts, but Democrats in Massachusetts are only 37%. Massachusetts, even as blue as state,
even the People's Republic of Massachusetts, 37%.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Democratic.
And I have another feeling, Miles, about what happened on Tuesday. And that may well be a revolt of the haves. I think that these were affluent people. There were also people, of course, living in Massachusetts already have health insurance. So the idea of piling national health insurance on top of state health insurance may have seemed to many of them to be redundant.
That's sort of close to the bone in Massachusetts itself. But Ross and Jay, I mean, it doesn't make me feel good that pollsters like independents, because I'm wondering, and maybe just taking the contrary view myself here, Ross, if this inchoate anger going back and forth, first in, then out, is a mechanism for making pretty bad policy of never getting anything done, Ross?
Well, I think that's certainly a danger. When you have voters who really have no enduring set of views about what the appropriate role of government is, for example, sometimes thinking perhaps it ought to be more interventionist, other times less interventionist, I think it just complicates things, and I think it makes trying to figure out what the voters are thinking a lot more difficult. I mean, I agree with Jay that certainly we've seen a trend toward these so-called independents becoming more conservative. And there's a school of thought that says there really are no true independents. There are leaners, that there are independents who lean Democratic and independents who lean Republican. And I think if Jay's numbers are right, I think probably the leaning toward the Republicans seems to be the most recent trend.
All right, Jay, very quickly, give us a sense, factor this into the midterm election.
Well, the midterm election is going to be interesting, to say the least. And I think it's definitely true, to John's point a moment ago, that it makes things difficult to get done in Washington. But I would say that really, independents would agree with that. And that's why they're independent. They see partisanship as the real problem here.
Jay Campbell, Ross Baker, thanks for the political talk this morning. Appreciate it.
All right, coming up this hour, we're going to talk tech every Thursday, our tech segment. And this week, the Apple Buzz. Yes,
you're excited about this,
aren't you? They've got an IT project. No, it's not a commercial for Apple. We're going to have a hard discussion of the IT product from Apple.
He's got notes. He's got notes on his Newton there.
First adopter.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Miles O'Brien.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And $300 million, that's what donors have contributed to major U.S. charities since the earthquake in Haiti struck. And that's something to be proud of. But the mechanism of disaster-motivated giving, as opposed to constant giving so that disasters will have the ability to draw on resources without compelling people to emotionally go to their pocketbooks is perhaps a better approach. Matthew Bishop joins us, New York Bureau Chief for The Economist and co-author of the fascinating book Philanthrocapitalism, How Giving Can Save the World. So, Matthew Bishop, $300 million makes you feel good?
Yeah, it's an amazing response by people around the world to this terrible disaster. The thing that we write about in the book Philanthrocapitalism is, you know, how do we make sure that our giving is effective? And the trouble with so much of our giving is that we wait until we see an event like this that is emotionally very, very moving, and we focus our giving on that kind of disaster. But what happens is there are a lot of issues out there in the world that in many ways are much more devastating even than the terrible earthquake we've seen in Haiti. You know, diarrhea, for example, kills a million people every year, and is very, very difficult to raise money for. And so how is it we can change our human responses so that we're not just giving to what moves us emotionally, but what actually makes our money go as effectively as possible?
Now, you raise a provocative point in the Daily Beast where you talk about some of the coverage and some of the solicitations being something called poverty pornography. What do you mean by that?
Well, this is a phrase that someone else has coined, which is that really more and more charities are relying on shocking images to get people to give, because they're trying to shock people's emotions into opening up their checkbooks. And unfortunately, that means that those causes that can't shock in the same way, that you can't get an image that arrests people, are actually losing out when it comes to fundraising. And so in many cases, those may be causes that it would be easier for us to solve than some of the terrible situations that are most shocking when we see the pictures.
So, Matthew Bishop, you've mentioned dysentery and diarrhea as one of the causes that gets short shrift in a moment like this. But in a perfect world, give us a model that might actually deliver the resources that you would think are appropriate and some targets that really need attention right now.
Well, I mean, we are arguing, we argued in the Daily Beast and we argue in our book, is that people should be using their head and their heart. That when you are moved to give by a crisis like Haiti, it's important to remember at the same time that your decisions are going to be skewed towards those most moving events. But so at the same time, you should think, is there a similar amount of money I can give to a cause that is maybe more devastating but is neglected by our emotions, and so we're suggesting that you should match your gift. And there are all sorts of websites out there like Global Giving or Kiva.org that are able to give you less emotionally heartstring pulling opportunities, but actually perhaps more impact, more good in the long run. Yeah.
Matthew Bishop is New York bureau chief for The Economist, author of Philanthrocapitalism with a Model for Giving in These Emotional Reactions to the Haitian Earthquake. Thanks, Matthew.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Miles O'Brien, in for Celeste Headlee, on vacation, no doubt sleeping at this moment. John Hockenberry is here after a trip to Washington. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Coming up in the geek. You can tell I'm excited about this next segment. We're going to be talking about tech stuff. iPad or the iSlate or the I don't know. Right now, let's check the leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. President Obama and his allies say they may have to accept a less ambitious health care bill. That's after the Republican Scott Brown took a key Senate seat in Massachusetts. The president spoke about health care on ABC last night.
I would advise that we try to move quickly to coalesce around those elements of the package that people agree on.
Moving to Haiti, the frenzied relief effort continues. Boston Dr. Roberto Flores is in Port-au-Prince. He's treating a severely injured Haitian man.
Trying to make a decision whether we keep someone alive or not. And some doctors here have said, well, we just have to let him go. I don't want to give up on him.
Also in the Capitol is Adam Minot, a correspondent for our partner, the BBC.
Every bit of open ground we pass, no matter how small, people have set up encampments. They've put up sticks and laced bits of tatty plastic and cloth across them to try and get some sort of shelter.
BBC correspondent Adam Minot.
Taxpayers who make donations to Haitian earthquake victims by the end of February, according to a bill passed by the House yesterday and likely to be passed by the Senate today, will be able to write off their donation when they file their 2009 taxes. Again, the Senate is expected to pass that unanimously later today. Big international business story this morning, subject of our international business segment. China's GDP figures are just out. Its economy has beaten expectations. It grew by a massive 8.7% last year, putting it in place to overtake Japan and become the world's second largest economy, right behind the United States. BBC Shanghai correspondent Chris Hogg joins us. So in China, it's the economy, I guess not stupid, but woohoo.
It's remarkable, isn't it? When you think about it, a year ago, they were really worrying here because 8% is the level of growth they feel they need to achieve to create enough jobs to stave off social problems. And they were really worrying 12 months ago they weren't going to make it. Now they've gone way past it, 8.7% for the year. They're saying today that the reason they did this was the country's massive economic stimulus package that really helped to create jobs and make a big difference in the economy.
Chris Hogg, give us a sense of the scale of that stimulus. We talk about it here, but really compared to the United States, the China stimulus is huge. We're sort of more pennies here in the U.S.
Yeah, it was $586 billion in November 2008. And that was by far the biggest one as a proportion of the economy anywhere in the world. The difference was, though, that they had a lot of projects here that were shovel ready. So once they got the money, they got the go-ahead, they could just start these projects going. It created jobs and the effects started to be felt in the real economy really soon.
It makes it's easy to make things shovel ready when you have a one party, essentially, dictatorship there in China. Chris Hogg, thanks so much for joining us, talking about the 8.7% growth last year in China due to their own massive stimulus package. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
All right, put your quill down, John. It's tech time.
Will.
The Luddite over here. It's Thursday. The Takeaway. It means talk tech. We talk tech. And listen carefully. Shh. I hear the sound of some heavy hype.
Everyone's been talking about this iSlate.
What we all believe we're going to see at this January 27th event.
iPod on steroids.
A 7-inch Apple tablet.
$1,000 consumer item.
A Kindle killer. An iPod killer.
About 3 or 4 times the price of the Kindle.
It's all speculation at this point.
We're still talking about a mythical creature here.
What are they talking about?
Well, with buzz like that, it must be something sleek and caressable from Cupertino, California. Apple's new tablet, iPad, iSlate, I give up. Stephen Levy has some opinions on the matter. He's been following Apple for years, As his Wired readers know, he's also the author of The Perfect Thing, How iPod Shuffles Commerce, Culture, and Coolness. And Cliff Kwong is here in the studio with us. He also writes for Wired and blogs about design and tech for Fast Company, has some opinions of his own. Cliff, first of all, a lot of buzz about the name of this device, this amazing thing, whatever it is. iPad, what do you think it's going to be?
All the things that I've been reading indicated it's going to be iSlate. There were some, you know, sort of shell company shenanigans that happened to register that name, apparently under Apple's rubrics. So it looks like it's going to be the iSlate, although, you know, we'll see.
Classic Steve Jobs, right, Stephen, to be going around and grabbing names and filing lawsuits, all that kind of thing?
Right. Well, there's the criminology around Apple is, makes Russia look pretty shabby, really. And every patent Apple files, every trademark foray is examined pretty closely. And if every one of these things that people examine came about, Apple would have 10,000 products with a million names. So it's going to winnow down to one product and one name, and there's always something about that product, though sometimes people guess the name, which no one anticipates.
Is this going to result in slate casts and slate books? And, you know, is the language going to change again here?
Podcasts.
That is what happens here. You know, that's why, you know, half the words in the English language these days begin with a small I and a capital letter after it.
I'm going to change my name to iMiles. All right, Cliff, let me ask you this. Let's talk about what this product is.
Sure.
This is, you know, kind of an overgrown iPhone. Is that it? Or
right.
What is it?
I think that, to be clear, we should ask, what does this thing do? I don't think the world needs another sort of slim computer that's about 10 inches.
Hello.
Right?
Yeah,
we've
done that.
So the interesting thing, though, is that this is being touted as something that could potentially have a sort of rich media reading experience that, for example, the Kindle doesn't offer, the Kindle being like a sort of black and white book reader. And the reason that you even want something richer than that is that you could potentially then start migrating content like magazines and newspapers and even books, too, into something like the iSlate in a way that hasn't ever really been done before, ever been done very well.
So more function than the Kindle, more money. Stephen, they got to be nervous about this at Amazon.
Well, of course they are. You know, Amazon's strength really is what's on the other side of the Kindle is all those books and an easy way to get to them.
It's all about the content.
But Cliff makes a really important point here. So theoretically, based on what you're reading, and Stephen, what do you think? I mean, people could take Photoshop layouts and port them directly to this, and you're really creating whole new ideas of magazines. Digital magazines suddenly become a completely rich media concept with video.
And I think what's really been interesting is that essentially publishing companies, Condé Nast, which I was in Wired included, have been salivating at this idea. Basically, they've been begging the industry to create something
of interest.
They're already developing content for a device that they don't know exists yet. It's sort of amazing.
Well, Stephen, give us a little bit of the backstory here. There's a lot of tension between the publishers and Amazon because they got a monopoly and they've been offering up very low prices for these books, right?
Definitely. And then there's another player in there called Google.
I've heard of them.
Which is, part of this complication. You know, the story in tech used to be Apple versus Microsoft, and now we've got a triangle or a four-way thing going between Microsoft and Apple and Google and Amazon in some of these skirmishes, and in each. One, each company has sort of a big edge and dominance in one certain area and wants to leverage that to dominate in everything.
The power of four here. What do you think, Cliff?
Well, I think that the important thing to remember in this story is, when you look at something like iSlate and you ask why it's generated so much hype, I mean, I think the answer is that so many industries are looking to this as their savior, right?
Right.
I mean, you've got magazines, which 2 years ago people were saying were safe, but now are actually in quite serious trouble. And this something like this could really help sell the new idea of magazines. And Apple is good at that in a way that no publisher actually is.
I think we got two magazine writers here fighting for their jobs.
I think it could be. I'm detecting a little desperation in the room.
Well, I mean, I will say that it's not guaranteed that it'll work, right? I mean, there have been efforts like this in the past, like to introduce magazines to CD-ROMs and things like that that haven't worked. And, you know,
we'll see.
If a magazine is rich text, does it become TV?
I mean, all right, well, next time we talk, it'll be out, whatever it's called. Cliff Kwong and Stephen Levy, thank you very much for the Tech Talk. See, you actually like that.
More tech. I own a computer machine. Yes, indeed, I do.
It's the latest.
So go to our website. Actually, you can hear Mike Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, talk about Twitter, speaking of our tech segment. And we're still hearing from you about reaction to that loss in Massachusetts.
Coakley's loss is actually good news for congressional Democrats because it gives them an excuse to sell us out even more to the insurance industry by watering down the so-called reform even further. We only have 59 seats in the Senate now, they say. But let's remember, 59 seats is more than Bush ever had back when he was getting anything he wanted.
You know how to reach us, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
I'm Miles O'Brien.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.